Hello, and welcome back, Curious to Serious listeners. This is your co-host, Gabby. In this episode, I'm excited to share my conversation with David Drapkin, who is the Director of Operations and Strategic Growth at Psychedelics Today. So in this episode, we cover David's role at Psychedelics Today, including how he helped to create their newest program called Vital. He explains how Vital is different from every other training program out there right now and what students can expect to learn through this 12-month experience filled with lectures, community building, and experiential learning. We also discuss David's history in economics and how a near-death experience changed his path to working in psychotherapy and social work. Additionally, we talk about bridging the personal sphere with the professional sphere and what that can look like in practice. And further, we have a fascinating discussion on how psychedelics influence our religious paths and how that can relate back to bridging our personal and professional lives. Throughout our conversation, David offers advice on skill building, networking, and job hunting. And then finally, we'll wrap up the discussion with a reflection on the future of the psychedelic field and David's desire to change the narrative around the war on drugs using training, public education, and policy change. Be sure to check out the show notes for ways to connect with David, as well as relevant links from our discussion, including a very special link to Psychedelic Today's newest program, Vital, which helps support the Psychedelics Today team, as well as Psychedelic Grad. Additionally, before we get started, we want to take a moment to thank our sponsor. This podcast wouldn't be here without MAPS, whose continuous support has allowed us to keep the online Psychedelic Grad community platform free for all of our members, and it allows us to publish these insightful conversations for everyone to enjoy. So thank you again to our listeners for joining me in this really illuminating conversation with David Drapkin, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I do. Welcome, David, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Lovely to be here, Gabby. Yeah, thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's really an honor to feature you as one of the guests on our podcast. My fiance and I have been following Psychedelics Today and the whole team for a couple of years now, and we both owe so much to our personal lives and to our professional lives for everything that the Psychedelics team does. So thank you so much for all of that.
Well, I've only been with the team 7 months, so I'll definitely take on a bit of credit for what we've done in the last 7 months. But yeah, that's why I joined Psychedelics Today, because I really loved what Kyle and Joe were saying and what they represent. You know, it's a great company, awesome training that I did, last year. And yeah, it's fun, exciting, a bit crazy. So it definitely matches me very well.
That's great. So actually, to get us started, let's talk about your position as the Director of Operations and Strategic Growth at Psychedelics Today. So if you could tell us a little bit about Psychedelics Today for those listeners who don't know much or haven't heard of that yet, and tell us a little bit about what your role is there and what you do.
So Psychedelics Today is a digital media education and training company in the psychedelic space. So we've been around 6 years. And over that time, I think we've recorded around about 350 podcast episodes, about 2.7 million downloads in that time. So we talk a lot. You know, we really have given a lot of opinions about, you know, psychedelics from multiple perspectives. And then we've also crafted a number of different courses to help people that are interested in psychedelics learn about, you know, them, and from different perspectives of, you know, depth psychology, Jungian archetypes. We can look at the history of it, the religious side of psychedelics, as well as the more kind of clinical therapeutic ways of working with people that do use psychedelics. So we've just launched another big training program called Vital that we'll talk about a wee bit later. My role has been to help us develop this new program, that Vital, this 12-month course. It was a huge effort to design the curriculum, to identify the VIP teachers, the weekly study group teachers, to design the marketing materials. And it's been an amazing project to work on. And then I also get involved in the podcast as well, and a little bit, you know, blog articles and a bit of training as well. So really a hands-on job, but very exciting. And I think the next area that Psychedelics Today will be going into is going to be more the experiential side of things. So retreats, conferences, webinars, and kind of wellness partnerships as well that we want to develop with some of our people that are in the space that we really trust and want to build new programs that combine the psychedelics with wellness and the media and training aspects as well.
That was a great explanation. I think you covered all the bases there. And I know like everything that I've gotten from psychedelics today has been great. So I'm super excited to see the new adventures that the team, you know, is working on in the future. I want to take a minute and talk about the new course that you brought up, Vital. Tell us about what that is, who might be interested, what's it all about?
You got it. So Vital is our new offering. It's a 12-month certificate training course. So far we've been providing our Navigating Psychedelics course as our longest duration training of 8 weeks. So Vital is 12 months. So a really significantly larger, more ambitious project that helps to project our belief system, our skills and ideology around psychedelic usage in the clinical setting, as well as in the non-clinical setting. So we recognize that there are clinical trials, there is the FDA process that psychedelics are going through, and that psychedelics have been used for thousands of years outside of the FDA infrastructure and framework. So just to recognize that reality, that psychedelics have been used for thousands of years and people are using them now outside of, you know, clinical FDA-approved DEA-sanctioned ways. And so from a harm reduction perspective and wanting to also be able to share the evidence base and research base and focus on clinical skills, we really want people that are doing psychedelic work already, either with themselves, within their own bodies and consciousness, or that they're sitting for other people, to be able to provide education, research, protocols, training skills, as well as experiential contact with the non-ordinary states of consciousness. So that could be breath work. It's just something that we've always spoken very strongly about, the work of Stan Grof, you know, holotropic breath work, other forms of breath work, as well as, you know, meditation and being in nature. But yes, psychedelics definitely are a focus area. So this course is open to clinicians and therapists primarily, but we're getting applicants that are doctors, that are nurses, massage therapists, yoga teachers. They work in retreat centers. They're PhD students. You know, they're working on clinical trials. They're working on the MAPS MDMA training. But there's been something missing so far in a lot of the other trainings, is that it doesn't necessarily cover some of the deeper parts of integration work, and that students that are not clinically licensed practitioners aren't able to join those cohorts. So our application process is open to students that don't necessarily have a clinical license. They still need to, you know, pass our application process, and we do have scholarships available as well for certain students. But yeah, we don't want to create obstacles to training, because there's just a huge need out there. Therapists are crying out for information, for skills, for leadership. And so because we've got our little soapbox that we stand on, we feel like it's kind of our duty to, from a harm reduction perspective, and respecting and appreciating the amazing research that's happening out there, the articles, the thought leadership, and the decades, centuries and millennia of experience, to start providing this information. It's not esoteric. And it will help to save lives, and it will help to prevent traumatizing, suboptimal, deliberate and irresponsible psychedelic use. We feel like there's a duty there that we have in the community, publicly and professionally.
Awesome. That's a great explanation. So for anyone who's interested in applying for the program, let's say they get in, what can they expect to happen over the entire training period?
Yeah, so there are going to be a lot of touch points over 12 months. So if someone's looking for like an easy ride, like get out of bed and like one lecture a week kind of thing, like my university days back in England, it's not going to be that. It is designed to fit around careers and family life. So that should not be a problem, but someone definitely needs to be committed to this. It's 12 months of weekly lectures of 2 hours a week, and then an hour and a half a week of small format study groups, working with a tutor and then guest presenters every week. And that's going to be four times over 12 months. We're going to have four modules between 6 and 7 or 10 weeks, depending on which module it's going to be. So each of those modules has this weekly touch point of a lecture, and that's going to be with people, you know, like Dick Schwartz, you know, Kylia Taylor, Omar Thomas, Manish Gurn, you know, a whole host of people. Just check out our website. And then there's going to be those weekly study groups, really building into the material, getting some guest presenters to do more kind of Q&A workshop type hands-on experiential learning. And then there's going to be two periods of electives in the summer, and then again in the winter, where your students will have a choice of short courses of four study groups with pre-recorded lectures. And they can just choose one course in the summer and one course in the winter. And they will also need to choose a retreat to take part in. So a 5-day experiential retreat, either again in the summer or in the winter. And there'll be 6 options available, both in America and overseas. And there's going to be monthly webinars as well, where each month we're going to be diving into more kind of nuanced intersectional subjects. And then each student that joins the program will automatically receive 2 years free membership to our online community platform. So a place to ask questions, to learn together, to celebrate the culture that we're part of, and to share resources and really, you know, identify those people that either have a similar thoughts and interest areas. It might be chronic pain, it might be PTSD, it might be addiction, it might be body work, or people that perhaps live in New Jersey or England. They might want to find community that way through our platform. So they've got 2 years membership there. And at the end of the course, everyone that completes the requirements will get, you know, a certificate in psychedelic integration and therapies. And we do also hope to lock in some exciting other elective modules, but kind of details haven't yet been signed off. But we're really hoping that we can increase the kind of tangible nature of what some of that training will give people in the long term for their careers. Because right now, yeah, there's no licensing authority, there's no, you know, board to recognize the training programs. But we are in negotiations with a few different entities to build into this course this year and in future years some more tangible you know, qualifications that enable our students to kind of jump the queue, or just at least satisfy the criteria of some other external providers and programs.
That sounds like such an exciting program. And I think so many people will benefit from it. It's really exciting because in my last episode, I talked with Sasha Koff, and he really brings up this idea of like experience, going out and experiencing things as a way of learning. And I really like how this program combines like the lecture portion of like learning, this community building too, of working with other people throughout the learning process, and then the experiential part. And I'm curious to know, I know you had mentioned breath work, but what other type of experiential opportunities are there for those who are enrolled in the course to engage with?
Yeah, so breathwork's going to definitely be a part of the theory base, a part of the curriculum and the study groups and the reading materials, because you know the tradition that Joe and Carl and psychedelics they belong to is, you know, related to Stan Grof and Elizabeth and Lenny Gibson. So we want our students to feel more comfortable with their own breath, within their own body, within their own consciousness. So that's definitely part of this experiential work as a professional, but personally as well. A lot of this training is doing the self work, you know, the integration on oneself. So it's going to be a recurring theme throughout the course. And yeah, there's also going to be this 5-day retreat. So if COVID is nice to us, please God, then this will be real in-person work. So we will physically be together. So taking our community structure, we're going to have 6 retreats scheduled over the year. And we're looking at having some in America, hopefully doing things like cannabis-assisted psychotherapy, as well as breath work, and then some overseas. And we've got partners that we're very close to confirming in both Jamaica and in the Netherlands for doing psilocybin work and truffles work. So, you know, we feel really importantly to give students some safety and some space in order to go deep within and to be familiar with those spaces that they will be working through for the rest of their lives in their own integration work, as well as hopefully being able to help people and hold space for other people and help other people stay safe and be able to make sense of their own experiences. So that is a requirement of the course, whether it's breath work, you know, cannabis assisted, psilocybin assisted, or potentially ketamine assisted, if that ends up being viable. We're looking into that with some partners as well. But yeah, that's one of the important components. I don't want to, you know, make it seem like it's a bigger deal than it is, but it's definitely an exciting and important piece that we create space and we hold space and that we meet each other in those spaces and are able to feel a familiarity of what those spaces within us feel like, because then it lets us just have a little bit more humility. Yeah, and firsthand experience of some of the possibilities, especially when we start to talk openly in integration circles with each other. So our students will be doing that during these 5-day retreats. We'll be talking about our own integration work. We'll be doing some integration work throughout the whole 12-month experience. It's an integration journey. Everything that you've gone through since you were born, everything that you've learned and unlearned, we're taking that all into this space of, yeah, like a crucible of transformation. Personally, professionally, bring your whole self here and let's really walk away after 12 months feeling a little bit transformed, growing and learning and feeling very grateful for what we shared. So that's the vision, Gabby. And yeah, we've got a good plan in place, great people to be part of the journey, the teachers, the faculty. And yeah, I truly believe it's unique and there's nothing like this out there.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to mention, is that I've never heard of any type of program or training or anything that follows, you know, any line that's similar to this. So this is really unique and it's so exciting to see this come about. And I'm super excited to see how the first year of students go through it and what they come out with in the end. Like, it's going to be really exciting to see. And this is just the beginning. This program seems so promising, and to see where it grows from here will be an adventure in itself.
Yeah, this is year one. Like, wow, if we're doing this in year one, what is it going to be like in year two and year three? So, you know, this is us being a little bit cautious, but at the same time, it's extremely ambitious and it doesn't yet exist. You know, we're honored that, you know, our networks over the few years have been able to bring in wonderful teachers. So we've got people like Ben Sesser and Devon Christie, Kylia Taylor, the MIT offers, you know, Dick Schwartz, Adele LaFrance, Reed Robinson, Luis Eduardo Luna, Courtney Barnes, Giuliano Mulligan, Andrew Tatarski, Jerry Brown, Charles Nichols. I'm looking at the list, Michael Shapiro, Ido Cohen, you know, and David Luke. So those are just some of my favorites that we've got confirmed to teach subjects that they are world experts about. And then we've got our faculty team to help break that down each week. What does that mean? What do we do with this? How do we apply this to our work, to our life, and to what we've been learning so far in the course? So yeah, it's just wonderful to bring people together, wonderful conversations to have. And it's just time to be kind of grown-ups about this and say, this is happening. We need the right skills. We need to listen to the right people. This is about, saving lives and learning the right protocols, learning how to kind of hold space and building our own resilience skills, our self-awareness skills to do our own work. To be held in a community so that we're kind of accountable to each other. And so we're kind of working in a really ethical and evidence-based way.
Nice. Very exciting to see this happening. And just so thrilled to see where it will go from here.
Thanks, Gabby.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else that you want to add about psychedelics today or your role there before we jump into your earlier years and talking about the journey of how you found your way into psychedelics today?
Oh, you know, if you haven't found your way to our podcast, please do. We're on all the usual channels. And, you know, we have our website, psychedelicstoday.com. And, you know, we have our podcasts and blog articles and other, you know, offers on our other website, psychedeliceducationcenter.com. So just look at those two sites and yeah, just listen to our podcast. We have two a week, and some great offers that we have there and some new trainings that are coming out. And yeah, looking forward to Psychedelic Grad, having our trainings on your website and building the relationship. So yeah, I think, yeah, there's lots more, but I think that's great for now, Gabby. Thank you.
Yeah, and I will definitely second the podcast, the blog, even the other courses, the Navigating Psychedelics course, all of it over the last several years for me have been incredibly instrumental in my personal and professional development. So I cannot praise them enough and highly recommend that our listeners go over to the website, check out the podcast, check out the blog, tons of information on there.
Yeah, awesome. All right. So what do you want to know about me? You said something about a personal journey. Gosh.
Yeah. So I know we had talked before. You actually spent several years in the field of psychotherapy. So Let's kind of start there. Let's talk about how did you find your way to psychotherapy to begin with? What drew you to it? And what did you do with psychotherapy before finding your way into the psychedelic space?
Yeah, so it's definitely a long story. So I'll mention a few key points that led me towards psychotherapy and becoming a social worker. So initially, I started off wanting to be a stockbroker, mergers and acquisitions, and that's the path I was going down. I was doing economics, president of the University Economic Society. I had a stock market portfolio that I got from my bar mitzvah that I managed actively for a good like 7 or 8 years. And then I had a near-death experience when I was 21. And then everything changed. I talk about this a lot, so it's a bit of a broken record, but it literally was probably the most life-changing experience that I've ever had. And I'm 43 now, and looking back, yeah, I think still that moment when I was 21, I decided not to be a stockbroker, not to move to London and go into mergers and acquisitions and, drive a Ferrari and all of that stuff. And I realized that I didn't have a clue who I was. I was full of shit. And I was just obsessed with, pretending I was a certain kind of version of myself that I hadn't truly given myself the opportunity to explore yet and to find and discover, reveal and create. So I kind of took a few steps back and went deep within. And, the next stages of the journey were a lot of world travel. So moving around the world, I feel very privileged, to be honest, to be able to use my passport to go in and out of countries for, a good 10 years or so, and doing some wonderful community work around the world, and doing a lot of meditation and retreats and fasting and learning a lot about myself and having some great experiences, in nature. And then I realized, I need to earn some money as well, because I'd like to get married and have kids one day. So when I was about 31, I decided I'm going to go back to school. So I did my second master's degree, again in social work, like my first one, but this time it was more in clinical social work, whereas the first one was more in international social development. So kind of humanitarian projects, international aid work, things like that, refugees, gender empowerment, sanitation and nutrition. So I decided, I actually think I would rather work with individuals, like people and the mind and the spirit and emotion. So I went down that path of social work school in England, and then happened to marry an American woman, came to America, and then yeah, just totally went down a psychotherapy journey. Did some training at the William Allenson White Institute in New York City, which is quite an esteemed education facility that does psychoanalysis training. That was fantastic. And yeah, just added on different trainings here and there. Did a lot of work in addiction, psych hospital, inpatient, outpatient psych and outpatient addiction work. Just getting lots of different skills, working with people one-on-one, kind of running groups, and just getting that experience doing inpatient psych work and doing addiction work, working with people that are, having overdoses, they're in recovery, that have trauma, that are experiencing psychosis, suicidality, panic attacks, they have PTSD. It's a real humbling role and a very beautiful place to meet people. So it's, very humbling that I was able to work with thousands of people and to have learned from them, to be honest. And yeah, the psychotherapy piece is definitely something that I hope I'll always do. But as I've found, as my roles have shifted a little bit over the last 3 to 5 years, I'm kind of getting in touch again with that business side of me, that part of me that likes to think about, you know, the big picture, business plans, you know, partnership developments and strategic, you know, visionary models of how could this look? What is the problem? Where's a gap? What's going to fix this? You know, and just being quite creative around the intersection of clinical treatment, psychedelic healing, and, you know, business development, strategic growth, relationship, partnership building. Because really it's about just being real and having real conversations. And there's some wonderful intersections out there that if we don't fill those gaps where the intersections are between business, society and culture, clinical kind of scientific research, and kind of personal, social, community healing, if we don't fill those gaps, then other people will, and they probably won't have great intentions, or they'll just look for much bigger profit margins than we will, you know. So a part of working for psychedelics today is really trusting the vision here and wanting to be part of a bigger family of aligned companies and organizations and people around the world that we can say, yeah, this is important to us. We really want to honor this work. It's a sacred work, and money is part of it, but it's not to be bought by whoever has the biggest checkbook, or whoever has, you know, the biggest VC company or whatever it might be behind them, you know. So it's not necessarily bad that there are VC companies, investors, and IP and patents and all of this stuff happening, you know, in the psychedelic space right now. Not inherently, but it does take a very discerning eye to hold these players accountable, to have true authenticity and being above board. Like, what's your motivation? Who are you? What is it you want to do here? Like, what's the vision? And do you want to share the responsibility here for healing? Because it's not something that I feel should be privatized. In America particularly, there's that significant fear and potential for privatization and corporatization of psychedelics, as we have seen with everything else in this country, that is quite different to, say, New Zealand or Britain, you know, or even Israel, three countries I've lived in. Nowhere else has the risk level and threat level than America does, as well as on the other side of that, the equation, people would say, yeah, well, no one has the potential to scale and the opportunities for growth and creativity. And that's also true, yeah, but we don't have to sacrifice ethics for that. And we aren't going to sell out our community, and we have to stay, you know, humble and respectful of the origins, the roots, and the history of the psychedelic healing, non-ordinary states of consciousness, and simply consciousness and humanity itself.
Very well said. And that really helps me navigate my own kind of perceptions of, like, how do we deal with the commercialization essentially of psychedelics. And like you said, I think as someone who's born and raised and have lived my whole life in America, the idea of just commercialization of exponential growth of everything and the focus on exceptional profit margins, it's hard for me to consider what does balance look like when it comes to the commercialization of psychedelics. But I think you help me put that in perspective of, you know, balancing that with ethics, balancing that with what is the mission, you know, what is the goal, and then kind of aligning the commercialization side of it along with that. It doesn't inherently have to be a bad thing. So that's really a useful framework for me to process some of those feelings that are so strong within me. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome, Gabby. And it's an interesting parallel process between, you know, as above, so below. There's this kind of meta overarching infrastructure that we're part of, and what's going on at a, you know, national level, but even state level, looking what's happening in Oregon. And you know, there's some really huge things happening on very large levels. And then there's also that dialectic within us, that parallel experience of, you know, who am I, and what do I believe? You know, what is my voice and what do I stand for? And am I okay with this? And that we're creating our own kind of internal framework as well as this external framework. So that's why these concepts of community, you know, that it's not just me, that there is thousands of us that want psychedelics to be accessible and affordable and safe, and to have people that are trained in how to keep people safe through using them, and to be able to kind of educate and inform other people's decision-making around this. So it's very much a harm reduction piece, both for ourselves and for our society. And right now there's, the world's not in a great place. I try and be an optimist as well as a realist. I believe that psychedelics on a personal level, as well as on a overarching societal and metaphysical level, can be part of a great awakening of humanity and a remembering of our true nature, which non-ordinary states of consciousness give us, because we have bodies that will die. And that's all great. And we have brains that are pretty cool, powerful. But ultimately, I think we are souls that transcend the birth and death of our body, and that has a unitary source of all of humanity, and that flows through all of nature and the universe. And, it's a never-ending journey to trying to, get a sense of what that means and how to put that into practice in real life. But it's a real pleasure, isn't it, being alive, to be honest. I've always been a big fan of it.
I suppose I am too. So it's interesting because you stated you started out in a much different position, essentially, and more in the economic kind of framework, and then you found your way into social work and psychotherapy. At what point did psychedelics or a psychedelic frame of mind enter into your interests and your professional interests?
Yeah, so professionally, it's really only been in the last 18 months, I'd say, that I've made the move into the space. And really, it's only been in the last couple of months that I've started to speak a little bit more openly about my own personal experiences with non-ordinary states of consciousness, which does include exposure to the use of psychedelics at different times and places in my life. And prior to that, psychedelics, were part of my life from a very, young age, as was cannabis and alcohol. It was part of, teenage life and 20s and 30s. I can definitely speak to experiences that were probably not so responsible, and I learned lessons from, as well as opportunities, that were responsible and that have helped me greatly dealing with mental health of myself and having, abilities to just tune in deeply and have a sense of what to do at different junctures in my life where I had decisions to make and maybe wasn't so sure. And particularly when it comes to personal or professional transformation, that familiarity with meditation, mindfulness, breathwork, yoga, being in nature on retreats, and psychedelic states of consciousness really helps to connect the dots together, literally neurologically, but also looking back on a narrative way, understanding our life's arc and the flow of, who we are trying to be and the way that the universe is moving us to grow towards, rather like how plants grow towards the sun. So I think the more conscious we are of that, the more easy it is just to, be happy and feel a little bit more okay with ourselves. Because I've had parts of my life where I've really not liked who I was, and there's that constant, part of me, to use IFS speak, and Dick Schwartz will be one of our teachers, because I really connect with the IFS concepts of, the parts and protectors and exiles. There's definitely a part of me that's an exile, that I have protectors around that I'm trying to bring back to be more familiar with, to learn from, and to love from a place of compassion and acceptance. So psychedelics, amongst other things, have really helped to go lightly with myself, to forgive. And that's the whole point of them, particularly, when you look at what MAPS are doing with MDMA for PTSD, amongst other indications. It really shows there's an ability to open up parts of life that hold trauma, and to kind of witness them and re-experience them in a way that's a little bit safer and feels a little bit more like I have agency and less shame, and I'm not going to be hurt again by those same situations. So, you know, I think a lot of the experiences that we have individually and collectively with trauma, psychedelics seem to have quite a lot of potentiality there. And I think especially for our kind of society we live in, with stress, anxiety, depression, kind of addiction and tech, and you know, fear about the future and fragmentation of society, it probably that ability to work with trauma and to develop a more familiarity within ourselves with that deeper part of who we are, and connect the different parts of ourselves. It's really, really important right now, especially with the pandemic happening. So, you know, initially when companies like Mindbloom started out doing at-home ketamine, I was like, I'm not sure if that's a good idea, because these are sacred medicines. And I wasn't even sure how I felt about ketamine, because it's a molecule, it's a chemical, it's not a plant that grows in the forest, you know. But because of the you know, the pandemic that we've got, because so many people are dying from suicide and addiction, and trauma is just really hurting people so badly, you know, I've really opened up to at-home ketamine. Definitely it needs to be done in certain ways that I think could be improved upon clinically, protocol speaking. And there's other companies I know, like New Life as well, that are moved into that space. But yeah, I think, God, we're just 7.8 billion people in this world. How many of them are struggling financially for food, for water, for shelter? You know, and I've spent time in India and, you know, Southeast Asia, and, you know, seeing people that, you know, really weren't even living on a dollar or two a day, that didn't have clothing or anywhere to live, and, you know, homeless kids, and, you know, literally people dying on the streets from starvation and nutrition. And here we are in the West, you know, we've got so much affluence, and yet there's also so much poverty and inequality in the West itself. And life is extremely stressful for us. So there's no panacea, I don't know how to pronounce it, you know, for, you know, the world's ills. And there's also climate change to take into consideration. But I feel like that unitary consciousness, where we move a little bit away from the ego of being David and Gabby, we connect with that part that is, yeah, that is sacred, that is kind of unified from a divine spark for all of our universe and all life that has ever existed. I hope it's okay getting spiritual, to be honest. It's part of who I am. And yeah, so, you know, I find it hard not to talk about those things.
No, I think that's great. And I think it's really important, because I'm sure there's many listeners that try to, you know, put themselves in a box of like, this is the professional me, this is the personal me, and, you know, putting their religiosity or their spirituality, trying to fit it in one of those boxes, when I think you just clearly painted an image of how we really shouldn't be putting any of those things in boxes. They very much flow and ebb together in different and mysterious ways, even, and how, you know, your personal identity is so important to how it influences what you do in your professional life. And like I said, we shouldn't maybe really be drawing boxes around those things. So I think it's really important and beautiful that you brought up and you're getting spiritual, because I think it's really insightful and helpful for our listeners to kind of view the ways in which they can merge their personal into their professional in those ways.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I think there's, you know, feel free to share your experience of being part of this psychedelic community or being interested in that this area. It has this inherent feeling of being somewhat radical, somewhat novel, cutting edge, a little bit, you know, kind of boundary crossing around intersectionalities, as well as having, you know, an ability to transcend norms of concepts and of social structures, and that it, you know, that personal, professional boundary. There's also that, you know, concept of, you know, the medical and the spiritual and the Eastern and the Western and the right hemisphere of the brain and the left, and, you know, the body, the soma, the kind of cognitive behavioral, and yeah, the spirit transpersonal, that these are all kind of realms and experiences that truly we're part of all of them in one massive Venn diagram, you know. I don't know, do you relate to that, a bit of that kind of feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Especially now doing my research, you know, my dissertation research looks at transformative psychedelic experiences at music festivals. And I've talked about this in a few other episodes, but one, I found a way of like merging something that I just really love doing, which is going to music festivals. But I've also merged it with what I like to do in my professional field of doing anthropology. It just brings, like you said, in that Venn diagram, it brings together so many things. The intersectionalities are endless, honestly, in the way that people talk to me about their experiences, the things that they share with me. And then the process of just engaging in my research, it's a form of integration for them. Like, I can't even tell you how many people come to me and they tell me about their experience and they're like, oh, I haven't even thought about this in so long, but it feels so healing to me. And it's just the process of me doing the research is it's so reiterative in so many different ways and crosses all these different boundaries within that Venn diagram. And it's really incredible and beautiful when I finally started to let those kind of walls come down of how I draw boundaries around things and really just let things flow for the way that they are. It's just really incredible.
Beautiful. Wow. And thank you for sharing that, Gabby. Yeah, I love that you're saying when you let the boundaries and the walls down, it kind of flows naturally. Like there's that sense that's just authentically what is meant to happen. And it just happens. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And something I constantly think about and I talk about with doing this project, because I've worked on a number of different research projects from food insecurity to working with environmental engineers on solving different issues and wastewater infrastructure and gray water reuse and environmental injustice, all kinds of things. But this is the one project that I've worked on where I just felt like everything just happened. Like I don't have to go out and beg people to participate in my research. I don't have to stress over, you know, how am I going to get enough surveys to get enough data? Like things just happen. People come to me. Like my network is just naturally building. It just, everything just really, really flows. You know, as soon as I let those walls come down, like everything flowed, the whole project came together. And there's really this merging between my professional life and my personal life where like I'm making friends with the people that, you know, I'm talking to about the project when I'm at festivals and stuff like that. And it's just, it's so incredible just how easy it flows when you just kind of, in a sense, it's very much like a psychedelic experience and like just surrendering and letting it happen. It just flows. Everything comes together on its own.
Yeah. I've always loved music festivals back in England. There was some great countryside in Devon and Cornwall and Wales and to have music outdoors, you know, is fantastic. And I also have been to a couple of psychedelic conferences lately, and it's a similar feeling, but very different, you know, and you can go to lectures and, you know, workshops and do tons of networking and schmoozing. And then you've got after parties in the evening and just great to meet people from around the world, literally, that have coming to really connect there. And great friendships to make in this community, in this space. You know, you can really, I find people that are interested in similar stuff. And it's just lovely to talk about geeky, academic, scientific, clinical things, as well as, you know, spiritual, social, cultural, ethnological, philosophical stuff as well as that. And it's really exciting. I'm loving it, to be honest.
That's great. This is an awesome conversation.
Yeah.
I'm interested, like, as you're finding your way through, you know, all of these different points in your life and trying to find yourself personally and professionally, how did you ultimately end up at Psychedelics Today? How do you find a job there? Like, how does that work?
Oh, it was a lot of hard work, to be honest, you know. So I was working, you know, in the traditional behavioral health space in an addiction outpatient clinic. I was the clinical director there for a while and doing really good work. And I've always loved working with people that experience addiction and substance use, you know, and it's good work. But there's a but. I was starting to feel a bit disheartened by, you know, our ability to help people and, you know, doing outpatient psychiatry work in the hospitals too, just seeing the scale of the need and starting to read more and more research that was coming out about psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. And then just learning more about, you know, the war on drugs and prohibition, and how treatments that were groundbreaking in the 50s, 60s, 70s were stopped for political, cultural reasons rather than science. or actual, you know, caring about society, that made me really kind of angry, as well as feeling, you know, passionate about wanting to be part of a new paradigm of the solution to a lot of the challenges and bottlenecks that we're experiencing clinically speaking. So it's not a golden bullet. You know, it's not perfect. It doesn't have 100% success. It's not for everyone. But from what the research is showing, it does seem to be a significant improvement. And the efficacy does seem, you know, rigorous, statistically speaking, on some of these big trials. And there's just so much more research to do. I'm a big fan of real world evidence and real world data. So I would definitely ask people to check that out. I know there's companies like Ozmind, like Awaken, and others that are doing real world evidence that is really, I think, that the next stage of expediting the commercialization and the legalization of substances like MDMA, psilocybin, DMT, ketamine, whatever it might be, so that it's reimbursed by insurance. So it's kind of reclassified on the scheduling. And yeah, I think there's just such a huge need out there. And so where do I see myself ultimately? I'm still not sure. When I decided to take the plunge and move into the psychedelic space, I probably had about 100 different meetings with people over the last couple of years. And, you know, good handful of them were job interviews. I didn't get some. Some I did get offered and I didn't take. Some of that was for, you know, ethical reasons about who the company was and where they kind of stand on the spectrum of corporate responsibility. Some was because, yeah, the pay wasn't, it just wasn't quite right, unfortunately, because there's not loads of money in this space amongst the more ethically inclined employers. And yeah, for some people that could work, but not for me in my 40s with a wife and two kids and a mortgage. So I had to really fish around quite a bit. And I've, you know, I was really lucky that Psychedelics Today had such a great vision and that they're, you know, growing so significantly this year and next year. So yeah, I just feel grateful to be part of that experience. And I found overall the process of reaching out to people really scary at first, but then it was became exciting because a lot of these people were wanting to have a conversation with me as well, you know, to get to know me and to get to talk about their company and kind of bounce ideas about this is who we are, this is where we're going, this is the kind of roles that we think we need, or, you know, the I would advise you that you speak to this person or check out this website. And so a lot of really friendly people making good introductions and wanting to talk. So I've spoke to a lot of CEOs and, you know, investors in the space as well that gave their advice. And, you know, I learned a lot and made some friends and have a good network. And yeah, so I definitely encourage people just to dive into it. I've spent long enough in my life holding back thinking, oh, that's not me, or who am I trying to kid? I can't do that, or it's not going to work. It's just going to fuck up. And, you know, it's don't even try, you know, it's too crazy and ambitious. And, you know, what will people think if I work in the psychedelics industry? Gosh, will anyone respect me? And, so there's definitely, you know, some in personal internal processing to go through here and conversations to have, but this is a industry that is growing rapidly. Like, you know, hundreds of percent over the next couple of years. There's going to be a need for hundreds of thousands of trained clinicians and therapists. There's a need for people that work in tech, that work in labs, that are pharmacists, you know, that are researchers and you know, PhD scientists and people that can develop clinical protocols and, you know, digital therapeutic platforms and all kinds of different roles that are needed to build out an infrastructure that is going to be working with millions of people within just a couple of years. So yeah, now's the great time just to get the training, to start learning informally by, you know, webinars and podcasts and video masterclasses and reading articles and, you know, going on different websites. So it's a really good time to soak it up. And then to see what transformation happens through soaking up that knowledge and through directing one's own sense of self and vision and hope for how you would like to impact the growth of the psychedelic space. And there's so many different, you know, companies and individuals to work with based on, you know, how much money you want and how many ethics you have and what kind of roles you want to be involved in. So yeah, plenty of opportunities out there.
Yeah, I think that's some really great advice. And something it makes me think about in my own experience when it comes to networking is I found that the more I was open about my psychedelic interest, whether someone be comfortable with telling about their own personal experiences, if they have them or not, but just being open about my psychedelic interests, like somehow we're all magnetized to each other. And like once someone finds out you're interested in psychedelics and they're interested in it too, like it draws more people in and it kind of helps you grow your network in a really natural way.
Yeah, it's nice again how it flows with other people, because there's people coming here for similar reasons. Like they have similar hopes and they want to give very similar offerings into the space. And yeah, this is global. Like, you know, there's wonderful things happening all around the world. So in Europe and in England, and you know, we've got partners in Costa Rica and Jamaica and Mexico, and you know, just wonderful people. And Canada is a great place right now. You know, probably in some respects, a couple of steps ahead than America. So yeah, just fantastic things happening. Just we have to know about it. So that's where kind of public education is really important. We've got the personal, professional education, but yeah, there's public education. I was saying, you know, that there's millions of people that's going to need to be treated, and hundreds of millions of, you know, sessions, and hundreds of thousands of clinicians needing to be trained. So the message needs to be somehow disseminated to the masses when it comes to, you know, psychedelics are safe. They are going to be, you know, legalized. They have been used for thousands of years to destigmatize some of the false narratives of the political classes of the last, you know, 50 years or so, to really show the evidence and to, be able to highlight those honorable characters in the space that are coming from a place of authenticity, that, you know, doing this from in a responsible and ethical and evidence-based way. So, you know, I'm a really big fan of people like Rachel Yehuda, for example, at Mount Sinai Hospital, where I actually worked for a few years in Manhattan. She's doing amazing work around PTSD treatment, working with veterans in particular. I'm a big fan of Awaken in England, and David Nutt, Ben Sessa, those folks. Chacruna as well is a fantastic organization. Biela Bate, you know, TAM Integration, Daniel Shankin, psychedelic support. And then there's other websites like Psilocybin Alpha that I've used to get just a little bit more information about, you know, the ecosystem. So just so many wonderful things out there to get, you know, a sense of community and hopefully a trustworthy news source.
Yeah, I definitely second all of those. There's so many organizations out there. There's so many networks to build on, and they're all really interconnected with each other too. So it's almost like when you start combing through one network, you start building out to all of these other networks too. So it helps naturally form all these connections within the community. And then before you know it, you know, everyone, or at least you feel like you're starting to really know so many people.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it, to have the geographical reach of networks and friendships and, you know, professional, you know, interactions expand beyond, you know, New Jersey or Florida, where you are, you know, and get broader, like national, but also international. It's really, really cool. And I think that helps to solidify the narrative about, you know, psychedelics having a role to play in, yeah, the international evolution of society and in the international response to mental health and addiction and pandemics and war and fighting and inequality. It has a part to play in, and especially when you start to look at some of the data that's anecdotally being collected from around the world, and particularly through real world evidence studies, humans are going through similar experiences all around the world. And psychedelics have been used for centuries and millennia to help people in a sense, hold trauma and to work through trauma and to have a sense of community and ritual and belonging, and to have elders honored and teachings to be passed down the generations. And we seem to have had that lineage and transmission of wisdom severed, unfortunately, when technology and capitalism kind of evolved into its kind of, just hyperactive, irresponsible period of adolescence that we are now kind of in the late stage end game of, I hope. So it can really evolve into a more grown up version of of capitalism and kind of global awareness about the problems that we've created and the reality of this is happening and this is what we need to stop doing. And then let's start to think about what we need to start doing more of differently. And I think communication internally within ourselves, within our own shadow, is part of that, as well as within our collective shadow as a global society and community. So we have collective shadows when it comes to, you know, genocide, murder, persecution, inequality, you know, kind of the corporate ownership of assets, as well as, yeah, patriarchal systems that still exist and discrimination that exists in education and in training as well. So a lot of shadow that we need to work on, and yet not much time, I think, to really kind of let the light shine through all of the shadow before harm increases significantly further.
Yeah, it's rough. It's really heavy. But like, I can see your optimism shine through, which is nice.
Yeah. If without that, it would be hard to keep going, you know, because psychedelics have to bring us towards a greater sense of wholeness within ourselves and that heaviness, that fear. You know, and some regrets, some shame, some blame, some, you know, difficult parts of ourselves that are very critical of self and of others. And that creates this sense of separateness and ego that I am not the same as you and that I'm better or I'm worse. I'm a piece of shit or you're a piece of shit. So different, you know, narrative voices and parts of ourselves that really need right now to be tapped into. And psychedelics really help. To bring us into that familiarity to, and I like the work of Roz Watts in particular. I think it's the ACE model. Let's see if I can remember what it is. Acceptance, connection, and embodiment, I think. And she's just come up with another version of that. I'm not sure what that's about yet, but I really feel like it's so important to build a space of holding within ourselves, and of tenderness and of forgiveness, of compassion and acceptance within ourselves for the arc of our life. And again, collectively, society wise, we have to own the dark parts of our past as a society. The things that are happening right now in America, in all parts of the world, you know, those are also happening within us as well, as above, so below. So there's just huge room for healing. And I think psychedelics can be part of it. But again, I always want to say it's not an easy automatic solution. It's not a panacea. It takes a lot of hard work just individually. And yeah, these are some conversations that need to be had between communities and within communities and within families and between the generations and between parts of history that haven't been healed, so that truly as a society we can feel a little bit more closely connected to each other and less likely to be able to tolerate others being hurt or others not receiving opportunities equal to ourselves.
I really like the theme of this conversation right now. And it reminds me of the conversation I had with Sasha Cuff, merging a lot of things together. Sasha talks a lot about the importance of doing self-work all the time. Like, you're always needing to do self-work. You know, the work is never really done. And you're kind of resonating that idea with this idea of doing our own self-work, working through our own traumas is really important, especially for those of us who are interested in making the world essentially a better place. You know, we can't do that without doing the work within ourselves. And so again, I'm seeing this merging between the personal, like the personal self and the professional self, and how like they're so interconnected and we can't siphon them off from each other. So I hope that our listeners find that really useful and they can tap into, you know, and start asking themselves, what can I work on within myself that will help me help the rest of the world in essence? So just really fascinating to think of it all interconnected in that way.
Yeah. And again, we've got our own personal trauma that needs to be, reintegrated and have the light shine through it, as well as, you know, intergenerational trauma. And I feel like the work of Rachel Yehuda around intergenerational trauma and epigenetics, I felt that a lot in my life as a Jewish man with, you know, my family were refugees coming out of Germany in 1940. Most were murdered, but, you know, a handful survived and moved to England, and my family from Russia and Poland, a generation before that, you know, again, there was genocide, pogroms happening there. So psychedelics really give us an ability, in a sense, that we could say change our DNA, but to have a different relationship with our DNA, to activate it in a different way. And on the level of, our awareness of our body, where we carry pain and stress and tension, and some of our, personality structures and, cognitive behaviors and patterns and, rituals, they do give us an opportunity to see into ourselves, and then to figure out what to do next.
Yeah, super interesting and fascinating, looking at the potential of psychedelics for within ourselves, but then also how that translates into our personal and professional lives.
The fact that you are so interested in music festivals and psychedelics. So music itself is a unifying consciousness experience, isn't it? Like, everyone's hearing the same music, and not everyone likes the same music, but you think if they're at a music festival dancing together, they probably do. So, they're sharing in that moment. In a sense, they're unified in that moment around that consciousness, the experience of the music and the bass going through them and expressing themselves in that moment collectively together. So, yeah, music, it has a holy kind of energy and a sacred opportunity to express self, to have, that kind of unifying consciousness, as does, meditation or other things as well. I think it's great. And music is a big part of the psychedelic journey and integration piece as well, so it can help both to prepare someone to kind of develop that relationship with themselves, but yeah, actually during the medicine work, it can really help to go deeper and to feel a sense of space being held, and as well as it can also bring up challenges. Music can be quite helpful, as can smells, interestingly enough. Certain smells can bring up traumatic memories, as well as being able to cleanse a space, to open up difficult experiences through the space being cleansed through, Palo Santo. I think, I've always been a fan of Nag Champa, but I think lately I've been, more down the Palo Santo incense.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. I've found, especially in my research, it's really interesting how the senses, especially in combination with psychedelic use, are so tied together. And even in moments when people aren't in an altered state, but they re-encounter a smell or they re-encounter music that, was really empowering or just powerful in general during, an experience that they had, like, it literally puts them back into that space and allows them to kind of re-explore that moment and that piece of themselves over again. It's just really quite interesting in how it's all connected. And the power with all of it. Yeah.
It's amazing that there's this inner world that exists. And once you dive in, it's like, oh gosh, this is infinite and never ending. And it's in a sense that could be somewhat like overwhelming. And it is. That's why we need this, it to be done in responsible ways and with the space being held in a safe way, because it can be overwhelming. And that's where spiritual emergencies come from, is at times, that vessel that we are as a consciousness, it might not quite be ready to experience, the infinite transpersonal realms, as well as our own personal traumas. And sometimes we might even feel that, like when I got electrocuted, I was saying, I realized I was full of shit. That wasn't actually who I was. And that was a spiritual emergence. I took years really trying to figure out, well, who am I? And, how do I make sense of this? And a lot of time was that just being spent alone. Dance, music, interestingly, became part of my life. Drum and bass music. journal writing, being in nature, meditating. Meditation and fasting. I think anything that enables us to develop this kind of royal road within us, that is infinite and has no endings, the different kind of pathways and networks within us beyond our brain and our cognitive abilities, but truly, I think in through soul and beyond our physical realm on planet Earth, to be honest. I'm one of those that think that's a higher reality. I don't know if you feel comfortable saying, I'm not saying, do you believe in God, Gabby? But this infinite spiritual universe that we're part of, that we can connect into a consciousness that, yeah, that allows us to be a little bit more free of self. Yeah, I don't know how to describe it. What's your, some of your ideas or feelings around that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was raised Christian and I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, and the town I'm from is very, very conservative. And whenever I go home, it's always a reminder of why I don't live there anymore. But I went to a more liberal college, and that was my first kind of experience of flipping religion on its head to the point where I was just like, what is religion anyway? And for the longest time, I really contemplated, am I Christian? Am I religious? What am I? What am I supposed to be? And I didn't really feel like I fit into anything. And it wasn't until psychedelics where, one, it taught me like, I don't have to fit into anything. I don't have to. And in fact, it gave me that freedom to explore and be like, you know, what does spirituality mean to me? Now I focus more on just like, I think a lot of it comes from trying to understand what goes on in my psychedelic experiences, you know, having moments of, you know, collective consciousness, feelings of oneness, connection to what feels like otherworldly entities, that kind of thing, really opening up, you know, my third eye essentially into what is spirituality. And my family would probably stop breathing if I told them that I no longer identify as a Christian. But I would hope that maybe they would find comfort that I'm still spiritual in a way, just not in a dogmatic or, you know, strictly defined kind of way, but much more broad, open to experiential interpretation of psychedelic experiences, probably. But it's really interesting how psychedelics, like, you know, going to a liberal college, like almost pushed me away from religion and spirituality altogether. But then psychedelics brought me back around and told me like, it's okay. You don't have to fit in a box. It can be what you need it to be or whatever you want it to be.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing, Gabby. It took a lot to step away and to let go of, you know, the conceptions and the frameworks that you grew up in. And then from that place of uncertainty, openness to find a pathway forward. So, and I think, you know, a lot of us go through a similar experience. I definitely did. I went through a time in my life when I really, you know, didn't like being Jewish, and I didn't want to be Jewish, and I didn't think I had to be. And, you know, I denied it and tried to run away from it. And, you know, I was Buddhist for quite a few years and lived in other countries and temples and monasteries and things. And after a while, I had just a few experiences that helped me come back to being who I am, like as a Jew, and to be able to be inquisitive about, well, what does that mean? And how do I be a Jew? And, how do I, learn about, making that real and celebrating that, and to feel more competent and, yeah, connect to my ancestors' rituals and traditions, and to be immersed in the flow of time and space through connection to my ancestors' traditions and rituals. So it took me a little while to learn what they were, and but the first piece was that they actually existed, that it wasn't all just a piece of crap and, you know, like there's nothing there to learn and money's good enough and, you know, I've got friends and I play rugby and, you know, I like football on TV. Because for a while that was sufficient for me. But then, yeah, when I got electrocuted and then started doing meditation and, psychedelics were part of the journey. Especially when I lived in New Zealand, because they grew freely everywhere, even though they're still not legal. You know, when I was a little boy, you know, I smoked cigarettes when they were not legal, because I was 11 or 12 when I had my first cigarette, and I drank alcohol at the age of 12, 13 at my friend's bar mitzvah and got drunk, didn't know what was happening, you know. So technically then I was breaking the law because I was, you know, 12, 13, and hopefully my parents don't go to jail, you know, 30 years later because of that. But, you know, yeah, the whole legal piece around how do we feel breaking the law, knowing that the law kills more people than saves. Just to be completely honest, cigarettes kill, I think, 150,000 people a year. Alcohol kills around about the same, I think 150,000, 200,000 people a year. You know, opioids kill around 70,000 people a year in America. How many people died last year of using magic mushrooms or LSD or MDMA? I think zero. As far as I know, but, you know, perhaps there's a couple, God forbid, there might be a couple of people in that. That's terrible. We should know what happened. And it's probably either because the substance that they used wasn't tested, or they didn't have the education and the mentoring to know how to take it, or how much to use, or who to be with, or how to prepare for it, or how to make sense of the experiences they had while they were using it. So that's not the psychedelics' fault. That's the fault of society and politics and law for creating this infrastructure that makes it more like the people will do things that are illegal and become criminalized and have a sense of fear and shame around their use of cannabis, psychedelics, that may well be coming from a place of survival, well-intentioned to cope with the stresses of life. And I hear so many people saying, I've tried antidepressants, I've tried cognitive processing therapy, EMDR. Those are great techniques, but I'm still really struggling to survive and not to relapse or to function in life. The MAPS trials, the average length of time that those control groups were experiencing PTSD for was 14 years. So the average participant in the MDMA MAPS trials they'd had treatment resistant, tried everything, and over 14 years, PTSD was really affecting their lives terribly. So, if these people are luckily just, 90 or 100 people or a couple hundred people through the trials getting access to this, and they're getting 60-70% remission of symptoms and being, diagnostically no longer meeting criteria, by gosh, why on earth is that not being put into hospitals and health clinics right now? MAPS did incredible work over the last 35 years. Rick Doblin, legend. But God, why the hell did they make those laws in the 1970s that created prohibition, learning from the 20s and 30s what prohibition was like on alcohol? Gosh, so many people have died over those years, the last 40, 50 years, because the trials and the research stopped, because there was criminalization of these compounds and plants, particularly in the age of fentanyl. It's ludicrous that even testing strips and equipment is considered paraphernalia, although I believe that is changing, or in the process of changing now, so that people can use drug testing kits on their MDMA or ketamine or whatever else it might be to test that it's safe, and to get correct dosages, like in Portugal or Amsterdam. That they have that kind of service publicly available. A long way to go. But yeah, the harm reduction approach of, say, people like the Center for Optimal Living, Andrew Tatarsky, Juliana Mulligan, who are teachers in our Vital course, thankfully they're great. People like, Gabor Mate is just doing fantastic work around, understanding trauma and understanding why people use substances to work with trauma, that it's a logical decision. And a rational decision to use drugs, even if it's something like heroin, to help them cope with something that is completely debilitating every day. And that's why the decriminalization, legalization, reclassification, whatever ends up happening, it needs to happen quickly, because so many lives are being lost with suicide and depression or trauma and addiction. And cannabis has huge potential as well as psychedelics for many conditions, mental health, but also, chronic pain, epilepsy, seizures, and Parkinson's disease, ALS. And so there's, ocular degeneration. There's wonderful research happening with cannabis, with psychedelics, cluster headaches and LSD in the company Better Life. Fantastic stuff. The MindCure is doing work, I can't remember the diagnosis or the kind of clinical terminology, but for women that experience sexual dysphoria and dysfunction, they're doing some work around the protocols and the drug development around that using a psychedelic substance. So there's just so many potential pathways that the substances and protocols and setting and kind of clinical treatment and kind of space holding and sacred ceremony can be used to make people better and function from a more authentic and a better integrated sense of self and well-being.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. The war on drugs and all the legislation that came with it is so harmful to so many people. And the fact that, you know, everyone within the psychedelic space, me, you, anyone else who's interested in this field, everyone who's doing work in it, you know, we're working so hard every single day to wind back the effects of the war on drugs. And it's exhausting sometimes. It really is. But it's so important, especially when I see it in my research, when I hear people's stories of like, I met someone, they went to a festival a few months ago, they Baker acted themselves. So they put themselves into a psych unit in a hospital, and they ended up getting out and going to this festival, and they had a transformative moment on LSD, and it literally saved their life. Like, they found like a reason to live in that moment. And so just like hearing stories like that, it's what pushes me to keep doing the work that I do. But it's such hard work. For me, it's like, what can I do? The people that I research and the people that I talk to and like the people like you that I interview for the show, like, we're all on the same page and that this is really important. The question is like, how do we get, you know, everyday people who are still stuck in the narrative of the war on drugs, how do we change their mind? And I know for me, one book that did it was Zimberg's Drug Set and Setting, which actually came out, and I think in like 1984, like mid 80s. But one of the main points he makes in the book with his research is that, and it's with all drugs, it's not just psychedelics, but looking at all drugs, is one, our relationships with drugs, they change over time. You know, sometimes we decide to use them less, other times we decide to use them more. It's fluid, it changes over time. There's multiple reasons to use them. And, you know, over 80 some percent of people who use any type of drug, they don't have an abusive relationship with it. And it's really, it's the hype of the drug war, it's media coverage that paints this image that all drug use is related to addiction. It's some type of unhealthy relationship with a drug. And I think it's so important, the work that we're all doing to change that narrative, especially for, you know, those of the people in the population that are still caught in the war on drugs narrative. But it's such hard work to do.
Yeah. And there's a really significant part of the process that we're going through around reconciliation, you know, with the past, kind of like we were talking about before. But yeah, just having these conversations now publicly is really important. So, you know, podcasts are really important. The war on drugs, you know, really created some very unhelpful belief systems. And, you know, I'm particularly thinking of people like William Leonard Pickard, that was recently, you know, released from prison. I think he'd been there for 12, 14 years. I can't remember, for, you know, production of LSD. So, he, you know, he speaks incredibly humbly and powerfully around, you know, his experiences and, you know, just more generally, how do we have reconciliation of a lot of the collective traumas that our societies have inflicted on, you know, parts of society itself, like parts of our own body, like we've harmed ourselves as a society and as a culture.
Wow. Again, a fascinating conversation. One more thing I want to kind of cover here. In our conversation before today, you talked about there's a number of skills that you've developed over time, you know, things like public speaking, project management, business development. How have you found that these skills have helped you in trying to navigate yourself within the new psychedelic space that you want to be in?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks, Gabby. Yeah, I don't honestly know the answer to that question, but it's a great question. You know, in a sense, one way of looking at, you know, how we evolve is looking at what's the next step I need to take, and what's the one thing that I really know this interests me, or I want to learn this, or I'm not very good at that, I need to get better at that, or this is someone I really admire, or these are skills I'd love to learn to have. Like, it might be, I really want to be on a podcast. So great, I've done that. Okay, great. You know, how do I do that? And I, you know, I definitely don't know much about how to be on a podcast. I just, you know, just talking, and one day I'll probably read some articles about it. So some of it is giving things new tries. I've always been someone who kind of says yes to things. Sometimes, you know, not so wisely, but I'd say 99% of the time, you know, I've been able to trust my judgment, And by saying yes to things, it's just great to try new things to expand that comfort zone. You know, I'm not a great tech person. So working at Psychedelics Today, it's, you know, we've got a virtual team spread around the country. We've got tons of different software programs. We use Monday. That is great, but a bit confusing to me. Slack's awesome. I love that. It works really well. I use some of the, you know, the Zoom platforms and other platforms for recording podcasts. And there's another one called Book Like a Boss for, you know, doing your scheduling on your calendar. And what's another one for passwords? And those actually flummox me. I'm not great yet on those programs. So, you know, I know that working in a digital media education training company, I need to improve my tech skills. So, you know, my colleagues, thankfully, at Psychedelics, they help me out. And I feel like an old fogey that they're like saying, well, hey, you know, this is what this means. Or you click here. Or, oh, that's because you don't have access to that and you need to. So, you know, those are my weak spots. I don't necessarily feel like we can't have weak spots and we have to, you know, develop our weak spots. I think we play to our strengths. So I've actually learned, to be honest, that my strengths are, yes, talking and listening, but overarching that is people, relationship building, and making people feel comfortable, and want to, yeah, share ideas, and kind of get creative and feel a sense of trust and safety. And that could be working with a client in a therapy room. It could be working with psychedelics. It could be doing a podcast. It could be doing a business meeting, strategic partnership stuff. So I realized, you know, oh, wow, I didn't realize that about myself. It's not just I'm good at like doing clinical assessments, or I work really hard and I'm, you know, determined and all of these things. It's actually people that I like. And so that's a really good thing that I've honed in on. And I guess, you know, for me, LinkedIn has been a really amazing tool over the last few years to understand the psychedelics world. You know, one, because you can kind of, it's a bit like a dating website. You can kind of, you know, pick the people that you have on your profile and you can choose, I want to like that. I want to get more of that. You know, I really love that news. So I kind of use it as a news service. And as a way of just hearing, what are people working on? What do people believe? What are people saying? Facebook a little bit, but not so much anymore. So, you know, as Psychedelics Today, we are going to be building our own community platform. You know, in the next couple of months, we'll be launching that to the community, to our students. So I feel like there's a thirst for knowledge, training, education, but bigger than that, for people, connections, interactions, community. Especially with a pandemic. And some of that can happen virtually. It can be a integration group online. It can be, you know, a chat room or a, you know, a little kind of hub in a online platform, but also in-person events like those psychedelic conferences I meant, you know, earlier, like Wonderland and Horizons that I've been to, you know, there last year, you know, and some smaller ones, you know, that are coming up soon as well. So I really feel like the need for community is really important, and the need for in-person connection to feel understood, to feel like we're part of something, and that this can really work, that this is, you know, a viable pathway for oneself, and, you know, that it's a really enjoyable thing to be part of something bigger than ourselves. It really is.
Great. I think that's some wonderful points in there. Whenever I think of skills, sometimes I think of like the typical like checklist, like, can you use Excel? I like the idea of like essentially being a humanist, being able to connect with other humans. Like, that's a skill. And especially in the age of COVID, that's a hard skill sometimes to develop. So I like that you pinpoint that as a skill. I also like that you identify, like, you play to your strengths, but over time, when you try different things, you realize, oh, like, these skills I'm not quite apt in, and these are something that I want to dig in a little bit deeper to try to get better at. And I think that's really good advice for our listeners. I know something for me with doing my dissertation research, I've always struggled with quantitative data analysis, doing like numerical stuff. And so I purposefully made a survey for my dissertation. So I'm forced to analyze that data, because then I have to build the skills. I have to get used to it. And then it's a skill that I can feel more comfortable with. And then it makes me a more well-rounded applicant when it comes to finding a job once I graduate. But I really like that idea of like identifying like, okay, this skill is not my best skill. What can I do to improve it? Or even just learn a little bit more about it and just get just a little bit better at it. I think that's a really key advice for our listeners.
Yeah, some things can't be avoided. That could be like our inner work, you know, on a very, very deep level. Some of it might be more profane and superficial, like I've got to get into this data, you know, manipulation and formulas, and oh, I've got to learn how to do spreadsheets, and I've got to learn how to use this password remembering software program. You know, I've just got to do that. So yeah, some things can't be avoided. So it's great to know that. And I've also run away from maths and formulas and stuff like that. It scared the hell out of me at university. So I try to just pick my modules and my courses just to avoid that. So no, it's great that you've embraced that. But as a therapist, you got to get training. There's no way around that. If you want to be good at what you do, but also if you want to just feel confident and feel safe and feel gratified, training's important to be able to identify what is my scope of practice. What am I able to do with this? What am I not able to do? Where are my limits? Training as a clinician is really important, particularly from a liability and a safety perspective. We have to get training to be able to do something, in a safe way, and definitely belong to a community or integration circles or supervision groups. All of those things are wonderful. And yeah, that's why we're offering all those things at PsychEdX Today now or in the future.
Nice. All right. I'm going to steer us towards wrapping things up here. And at the conclusion of our episodes, we always like to ask our guests how you see the future of the psychedelic field forming and how you see your role within it. So you don't mind taking a few minutes, you know, where do you see the future of the psychedelic field going, and how do you see yourself fitting into that?
Yeah, so I will say how I hope it evolves. Definitely there's no way of truly knowing exactly the many different kind of diverse ways that it will evolve, but it's definitely there's going to be multiple truths and realities of how psychedelic medicine will evolve. The starting place is just recognizing that it never stopped. It never went away. It's been used since the war on drugs and prohibition came down. It didn't go away. It's just been, you know, happening underground and in legacy operators and, you know, continuing in indigenous shamanic traditions. That has not stopped. So kind of honoring and recognizing that is really important. So those will continue. And yeah, when it comes to the legal side of things, policies and laws must change as soon as possible, because it's kind of ludicrous that, you know, just with cannabis, for example, it's federally illegal, and yet there are billions of dollars of profits being made right now in cannabis, and thousands of people are still in prison for cannabis offenses. That just is ludicrous and doesn't make sense. There's a cognitive dissonance there. So that has to be resolved. I'm very, very optimistic by the developments that are happening on state and city level. So Oregon, you know, kind of measure 109 and 110. Brilliant. You know, pioneering, not perfect, work in progress, complicated to kind of build out the nuts and bolts of all of those different programs in Oregon, but great starting place. What's going on in Colorado and, you know, Washington State and Texas and universities like Austin and Mount Sinai and, Johns Hopkins and Imperial College. Fantastic thing. So more and more of those places. Universities, health system, hospitals, venture capital, and hopefully more regenerative financing, such as that which was used by Vine Ventures and MAPS, of $70 million, no less. So that, I hope, will be a financial framework that more and more entrepreneurs can access, and more training of clinicians and therapists, yes, but also doctors and nurses, body workers, you know, retreat workers, and mass public education through podcasts and newspapers, and TV shows, and that we just need the message to get out. This is happening, and it's okay. You know, things are false that we've been told by and large, And there's a lot of great services and scientists and clinicians and therapists and healers and thought leaders out there. So money's going to play a part in it. Drug development, I think, is a crazy thing, you know, that it takes $150 million in 5 years to make a pill out of psilocybin mushrooms that grow freely. And then you can, you know, put it in a clinic and, you know, license that. And I'd like to see other ways alongside the FDA model. For some people, that FDA approved clinical pharmaceutical drug dev model will be the best. And they might want to do that. And they might have the ability to pay for that through their insurance, I hope, or it might not be. It might be through self-pay. But for some people, that's not affordable. They you know, literally, we know of so many people in every town, you know, in every country that can't afford to do that with a private therapist, whether it's ketamine assisted therapy or to fly to Jamaica or Holland or Mexico to do Ibogaine, to do psilocybin or DMT, 5-MeO. They can't afford that. They don't have resources. And yeah, it's great that there's some funds out there to help them access that, but we don't have enough, you know, funds to scholarship people going to Jamaica to do that work. So that there needs to be a real think about how the national, international systems will build the relationship around, you know, plant medicine and people using them. One, so that they don't get criminalized for using it. And two, so that there's a really big network of practitioners, doctors, nurses, and you know, politicians and lawmakers that are a little bit better informed than they are now, a little bit more enlightened, and just use the evidence to be able to enable mass utilization of psychedelics for those indications that it's targeting. You know, eating disorders, for example, OCD, you know, autism and ADHD. You know, and I mentioned, you know, women's sexual dysfunctions and dysphoria. There's so many indications, you know, alcohol use disorder, so many indications that psychedelics could be used for, that right now they would bring a significant improvement on what's currently available, which is why, you know, the FDA denoted psilocybin and MDMA as both having fast track breakthrough status. Ironically, you know, they are Schedule I drugs that are also by the DEA supposed to have no clinical benefit and be terribly addictive, which is both false, because they have this breakthrough status. And, you know, the work of David Nutt's very clear around that. So we have to overturn narratives and focus on evidence and research. And the work in Oregon, for example, is, I think, you know, really fundamentally pioneering the way forwards that provides a more accessible, cheap and affordable way of local people saying this is how we want this to be, so that we can afford this kind of treatment.
Nice. There's a lot of really great stuff that you bring up in there, and so important. So many things to consider when it comes to the future of psychedelics and what we can look forward to, or what we should be looking for. Accessibility definitely being one of the big ones. Making sure that people can access them, making sure that people are not penalized for using them. And I like the fact that you bring in that global scale, right? Just because you go to another country doesn't mean that you still can't get in trouble for using them. So having global discussions on what accessibility looks like is so important.
Thanks for asking that last question. It was maybe more than 2 minutes, but yeah, it's really important for us to connect those dots together. And it's been just a joy talking with you, Gabby, and very excited to see, you know, more of Psychedelic Grad and to collaborate with you and through Psychedelics Today and the Vital program. But just keep the conversations going, because there's just a lot of conversations that need to be had, and just so much potential opportunity in society over the next 5-10 years about, you know, how this can be, you know, a much better reality than what we have become attuned to since, you know, the war on drugs, and with all the, you know, difficulties we're currently going through. So yeah, exciting times. Love talking about it. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. And just in case any of our listeners want to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can contact you?
Definitely LinkedIn, as I said, is, you can look me up there, David Drapkin. You can also just see on the Psychedelics Today website, psychedelicstoday.com. So you can find our information there, info@psychedelicstoday.com. And our 12-month certificate course is called Vital. That's vitalpsychedelictraining.com. So you can, yeah, find me and us on those threads. And yeah, thanks, everybody.
Awesome. That sounds great. I'll be sure to include some links in the show notes for all of those wonderful things. Thank you again so much, David, for joining me today. It's been such a great conversation filled with so many things to contemplate and talk about. Just really wonderful. So I really appreciate you joining me. And again, I really appreciate everything that you do and the Psychedelics Today team and everything that y'all have done for this space. It's so important and so much appreciated.
Yeah. No, feelings mutual. Really exciting times. And it's great to be connected and to be working towards, you know, a very important mission together that we share. Thank you, Gabby.
Thank you. Thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. I want to direct your attention to the show notes where you can find a special link to Psychedelic Today's newest program, Vital. By clicking on this link and signing up for this course, you'll be supporting Psychedelics Today. Additionally, a portion of the costs go to supporting Psychedelic Grad so that we can keep providing resources and knowledge to our growing community. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like to connect with like-minded spirits, be sure to jump on over to the Psychedelic Grad community page. The link is in the notes below. And if you're looking for psychedelic studies, field announcements, and job openings, you can sign up for the Psychedelic Grad Weekly newsletter, which is also in the link in the description. Finally, if you enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a 5-star review and maybe even a comment so that we know we're doing a good job. Thank you again for joining us. I'm your co-host, Gabby. Stay curious, and we look forward to seeing you back here for our next episode of Psychedelic Grad's Curious to Serious podcast.